I'm Kelly, I'm an alcoholic. Oh, a dubious distinction right in front of me. I want to say thank you so much to Sue for asking me to do this, and thank you for your committee and for the wonderful hospitality that I've gotten last night and this morning. And I'm very grateful to be here and to be sober and, as Johnny Harris says, to be fully clothed and in my right mind. I especially want to say thank you to Domingo for a beautiful, beautiful AA talk. I can't believe how much was in that, in his message. There was just, everything that you need to know about Alcoholics Anonymous and the change and the transformation that can happen as a result of following direction and surrender and reading the book and everything that he talked about that he was willing to do, basically going to any lengths, was in that talk. And so I have my CD for the drive home. And the sponsees will get that as an assignment as well. We'll have a quiz, too. I guess I should start out by saying that three important things about me. I have a home group, and that's the Pacific group. I have a sobriety birth date, and that's September 26, 1984. And I have a sponsor. Her name is Millie Greenberg, and she's also in the Pacific group. The one thing that I always talk about, the first thing I talk about, because it kind of colors my entire story, is that there are two things I can't stand in this world. One is people, the other is reality. And that's why I meant to say that I so appreciate being asked here to do this, to come here. You know, all week long people have been saying, you're going to speak in El Centro. That's, you know, on the other side of the planet. You know, it's a long drive. And they're kind of like gearing me up for this long, terrible, hideous drive. Well, I drove out here last night, and it was one of the most beautiful drives I've ever had in my life. And I was thinking, why do I like this so much? Well, it's nothing but, you know, rocks and lizards. No people. No, the only people are in, you know, square metal vehicles with tires, and they're not talking to me. So I absolutely loved coming out here. I love just everything about it has been really wonderful, and I can tell that you have a strong group and strong message in your Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'll just begin with, my greatest resentment, my first resentment. I grew up in a town called Southgate, California, and it's in Los Angeles, and, you know, I always wanted to be from Palos Verdes. I always wanted to have, be tall and tan and straight white teeth and blonde hair, and, you know, my parents, he would be an attorney and she would be a model, and I have some of those things in my life today. I just wrote a check for all of them. And I never could be you, and I wanted more than anything in my entire life to be you. I could not stand being me. I didn't want to be from Southgate. I didn't want to have a blue-collar family and background. I didn't want to be, I wanted my parents to be interesting. I didn't want them to be middle class. They were middle class. Everything that I was, the reality of my life, no matter what changed, no matter how good it got, I just can't stand it. We have a wonderful speaker in the Pacific group that came to our Thursday night meeting the other night, and she talked about Marianne Kay. She talked about the fact that the normal person is so happy with just a little bland piece of this life, and they seem to be happy with that. But we get in trouble, and we need the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous so much, ever more so out there as much as in here, because I just want everything. My little bland piece of, 10 acres is never enough for me. It just... Now, after 19 years sober and getting the, living tar beaten out of me by the steps and the traditions, that's a different story now, because I've been rendered, to some extent surrendered to the fact that I'm bodily and mentally different. And that means a whole lot more than just putting the plug in the jug. If that were the case, I wouldn't need, if that were the case, you wouldn't have me as a speaker. I wouldn't be really an alcoholic. So I was just resentful from the get-go. I can't stand being me, and I always describe alcoholism, at least as I feel it in me, as it feels like I have a broken sewer line inside of me, and whenever I look in your eyes, you can smell the stench. And that's how I felt all the way up until the time that I took my first drink when I was 12 years old. And I took my first drink. It was a drink of beer, which I can't stand. It was in my house in Southgate, and I was 12. And when I took that drink, oh my God, everything changed. I will remember that feeling to my dying day. I mean, you changed. Reality changed. I could finally tolerate reality in people. I absolutely love the feeling that I got inside, that peace and that serenity. I'm glad that you are reading the traditions after each speaker. I mean, the promises after each speaker, because I got the promises when I drank. I mean, it was a new freedom and a new happiness, and, you know, I lost my fear of people and financial insecurity. I mean, it was just magical whenever I drank, and I didn't know that the feeling that I got that day was a feeling that was to keep me in bondage for the next 18 years of my life as I kept drinking, but I loved it. It fit absolutely perfectly with me. I was reading your the schedule of speakers and so forth, and I noticed that your theme this year is unity. That's very interesting to me because this week, quite often what I do for my morning reading is I will read A New Pair of Glasses. It's a great book by Chuck C. I think you might have it on tape here. It's a fabulous book, and he was telling a story about unity, and I want to pass that on to you before I get into my story. He was talking about the fact that Roland went a long time, you know, before Alcoholics Anonymous was really formed. Roland was an alcoholic who was a hopeless alcoholic, and he was trying to get sober, and he couldn't. He went to the very famous psychiatrist Carl Jung, and Carl Jung finally pronounced him utterly helpless, that he said in so many words, psychiatry has tried to help you, we can't help you. Medicine has tried to help you, they can't help you. The only thing that is going to help you is a spiritual experience. And he carried that message to Bill Wilson. Bill carried it to Dr. Bob. Alcoholics Anonymous was basically formed June 10th, 1935. Bill Wilson heard Roland's story of how much Carl Jung seemed to know about the alcoholic nature. And he wrote Carl Jung. And there was this wonderful correspondence between them, apparently, for a while. And Wilson asked Jung, how do you know so much about the alcoholic nature if you're not an alcoholic? And Jung wrote back, said that it's my observation that the alcoholic is in disunity with the God that made him and in disunity with his fellows, and that in seeking alcohol, what the alcoholic is really seeking is chemical unity. Alcoholics Anonymous, Jung went on to say, makes it so the chemical is not necessary. And so that's what the beauty of that passage in A New Pair of Glasses that meant so much to me, because I knew I was going to come here and talk to you, and your theme was unity, is that, you know, I was seeking chemical unity from my first drink because I am separate from, very profoundly separate from, the God that made me and the people around me. I began my talk saying that I cannot stand people and I can't stand reality. And chemical unity made all of that possible. And when I stopped drinking, getting ahead of myself a little here, but, you know, when I stopped drinking 19 years ago, I was absolutely hopelessly lost because I lost my unity. And through the steps and the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous and doing everything that Domingo talked about, you know, it's a long process if you're new to get to a place of unity where you don't need the chemical anymore. And I know that if you're new, it's probably very hopeless and very difficult work. And, you know, if you're new here, it's probably been a bad year for you. But I can tell you that the hope of my life is Alcoholics Anonymous and everything that's in the first 164 pages of the Big Book, because that's where I found my solution. If you hear nothing less today, if you're new, I want to tell you how I stay sober one day at a time. I read the Big Book. I read it pretty much on a daily basis. I have a sponsor. I am accountable to that sponsor. I go to 5 meetings a week. I have a commitment at all 5 meetings. I carry the message to other alcoholics. I get no less than 5 phone calls every single day from sponsees. I am in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the most important thing in my life. I go to a ton of meetings. And if you're new, you know, the most important thing that I can pass on to you before I say anything else, if you tune out the rest of what I say, if you tune out the rest of the weekend, I hope that you hear that the solution that I found that changed my life is in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, taking those 12 steps with a sponsor out of the Big Book. No spin, you know, no As Kelly Sees It, no insight, strength, and hope, purely out of Bigfoot, purely out of exactly as the Bigfoot lays it out for us, and that's been my solution. I'll go back to say that, you know, getting back to what I was like before I picked up my first drink, I mean, I was really restless, irritable, and discontent. I cannot stand me. I cannot stand you. The only thing that ever fixed that was Jack Daniels, and I'm a Jack Daniels drinker. I don't have a real exciting drunk along, no tattoos, nothing's pierced, but I can say that, you know, the way that I like to drink is I'm not a social drinker. I was never a disco queen. You know, whenever I wasn't a bar drinker. I like to drink, alone. I like to drink until I see triple. I like to drink until I'm absolutely on my face. I don't want to drink to get high or happy or be social. I want to drink to completely pass out and not be aware. And so, you know, I'm not, I've never had a girl drink in my life, nothing with fruit or an umbrella in it. It takes about 800 margaritas for me to feel anything. And so for me, you know, much of my drinking was done in Seattle, and the best thing about drinking in Seattle is it's, you know, lots of cheap Canadian whiskey from Canada. And I just, I don't know, like Norm Alpe says, you know, Jack Daniels just got me downtown really quickly, and it meant everything to me before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. So I'm restless, irritable, and discontent. I don't want to be me. I'm living in Southgate. I can't stand me. I hate my family. I ended up marrying my, I'll go back and talk about a little bit what happened. There were some turning points in my life. One was when I was 15, my mom died. She died of cancer very, very suddenly. As soon as she died, I began to drink every day. Those two aren't connected. I only mention that because it was a turning point in my drinking. The other thing that I want to talk about is I always wanted a nuclear family. I didn't have one. There were 8 marriages between my two parents. And you know, it's just always this river of changing faces of a new step-parent, a new step, you know, step-family. And I just never could get what I wanted. You know, it just, it's always about me and how you're not delivering. And so I just went through my life with this huge expectation, with this huge desire that was just completely unfulfilled. And when I drank, all that changed. I mean, when I drank, I felt fulfilled no matter what was going on in my life. I ended up marrying my high school sweetheart. You know, we left Southgate for the booming metropolis of Long Beach, California. And he made the decision to go to Long Beach State and start a long education process. He was going to go for a PhD in marine biology. So we made the ultimate decision to live in Seattle because he got accepted at University of Washington to get his doctoral degree. I went up there, and the thing that I wanted to do my entire life was to be a reporter, a newspaper reporter. And at the age of 23, I moved up there, and I got a job reporting in the way that I get every job in my life, you know, prior to coming to the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, is I walk in and I lie. I walk in and I tap dance. And, you know, as soon as I walk in and I lie, and I got the job as a reporter at a small newspaper in Seattle, you know, the heat is on. It's like I'm now lying about having a degree. I don't have a degree. I'm you know, working for a newspaper. There's all this expectation of me to know what I'm doing. I don't know what I'm doing. You know, the editors walk in the office and they say, you're burying the lead. I'm like, what's a lead? There's something called a lead. It's buried here someplace. We got to find it. We got to go, you know, dig up the lead. And then I got to go put it in the right place. So I'm just lying and tap dancing and drinking and trying to fuel it all with my bluster. And you know how it is when you're one of us. You know, I can't be right here with you. I'm always here. And the only thing that's going to get me here is never enough. When I drink, I'm here. And that's where I feel most comfortable. I just can't be a worker among workers. So I'm starting my whole life with, you know, drinking and things are starting to happen. You know, I'm starting to get involved in some domestic violence. You know, my husband's starting to get, we're living this devil life. I mean, up in this echelon of getting a PhD, and there are all these, you know, he's doing these really amazing things with people all over the world, and he's drinking too, and he's beating me up, and I'm, you know, coming to out of a blackout, not knowing where I am, not knowing what's happening, just with him, you know, on top of me, pinning me down, saying, you're drunk again, you're drunk again, you're drunk again. And not knowing what I did. I mean, I so related to, you know, what Domingo said in terms of there's just that terror of I don't know who I am, I don't know who I've been with, I don't know where I am, I don't know who this person is on top of me, I guess it's my husband, you know. There's just this insanity that starts to happen. So, you know, how I got to Alcoholics Anonymous is absolutely through the back door. At this time, I was starting to, as I say, become a blackout drinker. And I'm not getting into a lot of trouble in terms of law. You know, no arrests, no, you know, if that has happened to you, if you've served time in jail, you know, and you're here in this room, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You belong here. If that never happened to you, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. You belong here. It's not, you know, as Clancy says, it's not what it did to you, it's what it did for you. And he has a great definition of alcoholism that I always pass on when I'm asked to speak, and that is that if you're an alcoholic, alcohol will fill your holes. It'll make you feel taller and stronger and more intelligent and more interesting. And if you're not an alcoholic, it won't do that for you. The problem with alcoholism, he goes on to say, is that eventually instead of filling your holes, it makes the holes bigger and bigger and bigger. And I don't know when I crossed that line, but that's exactly what happened, is that alcohol made me feel powerful in a very powerless world. It made me feel better than you when I knew I was so far below you. And so, you know, I never knew about alcoholism. I'd never, you know, read chapter 3 of our big book. I didn't know what alcoholism was. I didn't know that you could have alcoholism and you could work full time. I had this cartoon in my head my whole life of what an alcoholic was. That they lived down at the, you know, railroad tracks, they ate out of a dumpster, they soiled themselves. You know, that was none of me. I never did any of that. If you did that again, you know, welcome. If you didn't, welcome. You know, you'll find all kinds of experience and strength and hope in Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, stick around long enough, you'll hear your story. So one day I'm in my office, and this woman walks in, and she's dropping off a press release to me, and she breaks her anonymity. And she tells me that she's from Alcoholics Anonymous and that she's been sober for, I don't know what, 7 years. And we began to talk. And she said, you know what, you seem to be very, very interested in this whole Alcoholics Anonymous thing. Why don't you do a story about alcoholism? And I thought that would be incredibly socially aware of me, to do a story about alcoholism. And you know, the alcoholic ego, it's not like we can just do one story. We have to do like a 17-part series. So I decided that, you know, the wheels started turning, and I thought this was going to be my ticket out of, you know, small-town Palookaville journalism. I'm going to, you know, the Pulitzer Committee is going to call any minute now, and my career is going to take off because I'm going to go into AA and expose them, and, you know, it's going to drive a lot of people into Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought it was like a multi-level marketing thing, or, you know, you get brownie points or green stamps or something. The more, you know, you get a commission where people, you know, they find out you're responsible for the membership growth. So I thought, okay, well, I'm going to do not just a story about, you know, alcoholism. I'm going to do one on public policy toward alcoholism and women alcoholics and kid alcoholics and dog alcoholics. And I'm going to do one on, I guess I may as well throw in Alcoholics Anonymous in there, you know, while I'm doing something about this huge overarching epic that I'm going to do about alcoholism. So she was great. You know, she set me up with all these members of her home group for me to interview, and I, you know, was excited because I would finally, you know, talk to a real alcoholic and interview them and find out what it was like to be an alcoholic. And, you know, I interviewed these people from her home group, no identification whatsoever. I mean, none. They had stories that weren't like mine. So, you know, at that time I was not an alcoholic. I was a deeply wounded, profoundly artistic white wine drinker. And so I had no concept whatsoever about what an alcoholic is. So, of course, one of the parts of the series was I had to do a story on Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I lived in Seattle at that time, and I wondered how it would be best to approach this story about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, well, the best thing to do, actually, if you want to infiltrate, would be to go undercover as an alcoholic. And so that's how I got to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, is I went undercover as an alcoholic. And so I decided to try to look as normal as I possibly could. You know, I tried to look like, you know, a professional woman, because I thought that's kind of how they dressed in AA. And I called Central Office in Seattle, and I said, you know, I'm a reporter doing a story about Alcoholics Anonymous. What do you suggest I do? And they said, well, we think you should go to the Fremont Fellowship. Yeah. I mean, in a crowd this size, there's usually a free monster around. And the Fremont Fellowship is, it's just a freak show. It's a great meeting, and a lot of people get sober, and they stay sober, and I got sober there, and it's a, you know, they're a wonderful bunch of people, believe me. But, you know, I was not prepared for what I was about to see. Because the Fremont Fellowship is like, my estimation, at least, you know, the first time I was there, was that, you know, you couldn't be sober longer than about 7 minutes. And you had to have, everybody that talks seemed to have the story of like, I you know, just killed my old lady in a blackout last night, or I took a hacksaw to a family of five. And I walked into the Fremont Fellowship undercover as an alcoholic, you know, like kind of dressed like this, like thinking, try to look as normal as you can. And it's like really, you know, scary guys with, you know, scary Hells Angels bikers with, you know, frightening tattoos. And with all these incredible stories. So I stuck out like a sore thumb at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, not undercover at all as an alcoholic. And the absolute opposite, as a matter of fact. So all these people are telling these wild stories, and there's just like, you know, there's a bank of smoke. You could smoke in 1984 and at that time. And there's just these this unbelievable, you know, thing that I'm witnessing, and I'm just shaking my head going, first of all, I'm writing everything down going, they're going to eat this with a knife and a fork, you know, back in the office, because this is like, I'm really exposing alcoholism now. This is the real thing. And this lady, this biker lady over in the corner of the room, you know, saw me white as a sheet, trembling, you know, in the corner of the room taking notes, and she kind of tiptoed over to me, and she said, is this your first meeting? And I said, yes, it is. And she said, well, you might want to try some meetings in the suburbs. And so I was just, you know, dumbfounded as to this thing that I discovered, and that I couldn't believe. I was so grateful that I wasn't an alcoholic. I just, you know, left that meeting shaking my head. And so I proceeded to write this story. And, you know, I want to stop here and talk for a minute, as I always do when I tell the story. I want to talk for a minute about the 11th tradition, because Alcoholics Anonymous has a set of traditions that protect us from ruining Alcoholics Anonymous. And in going to that meeting and writing down, this is what I did. I went to that meeting, I wrote down your name and your story, and the next day your name and your story were in the paper, because I did not know that we have an 11th tradition, that we are anonymous at the level of press, radio, and films. And if I had known that, or if the person at Central Office in Seattle had known about the 11th tradition, they would have suggested that I go to an open meeting. That it's very, very inappropriate for what I did in terms of just going to a meeting, writing your name and your story. You know, your pastor, your employer, anyone could have read that, and I would have blown your anonymity. And I don't know what's going to take me out. I don't know what's going to take you out. But I know that if I blow your anonymity, that might be enough. And so I have to be very careful today about observing the traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned a huge lesson about breaking that 11th tradition that day. In any event, in the year that ensued, a lot of stuff happened. My life got worse. My whole existence became very dark and very suicidal and very narrow. And I remember just always waking up every single morning sobbing, really wanting to step in front of a Metro bus. I just remember that I just drank all of the time, and I never was not obsessed with suicide. And, you know, some things began to happen. My marriage began to fall apart, and I went to a therapist, and I was telling her my story. And I was telling her that I was drinking a lot and smoking a lot as a result of this marriage breaking up. And she said, by the way, how much are you drinking lately? And I said, the normal amount. And she said, I'm going to ask you to do something that you're not going to like me for. In fact, I'm quite sure that you're going to hate me for this. And that was my moment of clarity. That was my jumping off place. That was the turning point for me, because it was read today in chapter 5. That was where I knew it was up. And somebody finally was putting a word and a name on what was wrong with me. And I also knew that that meant I had to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I also meant that it was no more as a visitor. It was no more undercover. It was no more. I mean, I had to go to AA because someone finally labeled me as an alcoholic. And I remember just sitting on her sofa and crying for about 20 minutes straight. You know, I just didn't know that it could happen to, you know, to people like me. I mean, I was just in shock. I wasn't one of those people in AA who knew I was an alcoholic before I came in here. So where else do I go? I had to go back to the Fremont Fellowship. And those people were incredible. They were, you know, it was a whole different scene for me now, you know, being an alcoholic, being finally admitting to my innermost self, you know, page 30 of the big book, that I was an alcoholic. I began to go to those meetings, and all the bikers were just wonderful. You know, they were just great. You know, the biker chicks and the biker guys, they would, you know, watch me fall apart and, you know, make me scrambled eggs and till 3 in the morning watch their Elvis tapes, you know. It was just a great, it was a great first year of sobriety. I will say, if you're new, that I had the worst, I don't know what your first year was like, but my God, you know, I was not surrendered when I came here. In fact, I was not surrendered for many, many years, sober in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. But in my first 18 months, I did get divorced. I was fired from that job. My car blew up. I filed for bankruptcy. I was so suicidal constantly that I just checked myself into a psych unit, you know, 3 times. And that was, you know, I've heard it said around here that somebody once said in a meeting that she didn't expect when she looked out her window and invited God into her life that she would look out her window and see the wrecking ball coming. But everything that I was, all of this, you know, this false foundation, this wanting to be something in the world but never being able to make it. It's what Keith C. says. You know, we can make it to 75% and then we dive. 75% and then we crash. You know, I could just never get there. All my lying, cheating, stealing, tap dancing, BSing, I couldn't get it. And so my life fell apart horribly. And, you know, when I came to AA, I hated you. I hated the steps. I hated the traditions. I wasn't really quite as bad an alcoholic as you are. You know, those 12 steps and those 12 traditions, they were fine for garden variety drunks like you, but they're far too much of a pedestrian solution for somebody who has such a, you know, deep wound as I do. And I don't know what was happening in, you know, this area in 1984, but I know when I got sober in 84, in Seattle, there was a huge movement that just swept through all of the meetings, and a lot of people were doing a lot of other 12-step programs. They were doing an awful lot of therapy. They were doing an awful lot of the AA gurus, and, you know, I mean, basically it was an easier, softer way that essentially said, you know, you can, maybe alcoholism is your problem, but that's just the platform that we start at. And then the real work is when you do your inner child work, when you do your, you know, family of origin work. And I just grasped onto that that easier, softer way like it was my life preserver. I was not surrendered to this solution. And I took that, I rode that until the wheels fell off in Alcoholics Anonymous for, you know, the next 10 years in AA. I was to pursue every single outside solution that's conceivable. I was not interested in your steps or in an inventory or in making amends. I wasn't going to be of service to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, you can't, it says in Chapter 2, you know, we have found a common solution. But see, I can't have your common solution unless and until I become a common alcoholic. When I become a common alcoholic, I get this very uncommon gift that's in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you don't know what that is yet, if you're new, take the steps. Get a sponsor, get into the big book, take the steps. Because there is a very uncommon gift that happens as a result of that process. So what happened for me is I just did that. You know, I many of us go there. I think the dry drunk is not really talked about that much in AA meetings, but it is my story. I thought that it was all about money, property, and prestige. I thought that Domingo talked about it again. It was very interesting to hear him say that because that was my experience exactly, that I began to take my power back. I mean, because I'd never surrendered, which is the first half, you know, the first half of the first step is I'm powerless over alcohol. I got that. What I never got was the second half of the first step. I'm also powerless over sobriety. If that's the case, just like he said, you know, I've got to turn it all over to a power greater than myself. And I've got to do certain things that, you know, I don't necessarily believe in. I don't want to do. I think is very damaging to my pristine ego. But I've got to do these things if I don't want to pick up a drink and I want to be comfortable in my skin. So what happened for me is I found him in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was the new flesh from Santa Barbara in town. He was very good looking, and he drove a new Saab, and he made a lot of money. And so, you know, we got together, we got married, we got the money, property, and prestige happening. We decided at the same time that we were, you know, we were well enough to graduate from Alcoholics Anonymous now, about 3 years sober. And we ohmed, we chanted, we had needles stuck in us. You know, we went to the retreats in the mountains. He studied Japanese tea ceremony, you know, I held my teddy bear. We did everything under the sun that has nothing to do with a program of recovery that we find here. And I'm not here to denounce any of that, because, you know, the people that helped me, I counted the other day in my first 10 years, I had 13 sponsors and 8 therapists. Dropped a ton of money to find what is here absolutely free. I did not know at that time that every single meeting that I went to, the solution that I was looking for is hanging on the wall at every meeting that I go to, and it's free, the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. And I had to find that the hard way. So we did our deal, and, you know, I decided, just like Domingo said, you know, it's time for me to take my power back. That's the problem. I came to this brilliant realization in my increasing dry drunk that the problem with Alcoholics Anonymous is it took my power away. And the worse my life got, the more I had to go against AA, because I had to get my power back. And so I did everything in my power to get my power. And it was really self-will run right. I went back to school. You know, that was the problem. I had no education. I didn't want to lie anymore. I'd been lying for 12 years about having a degree, so I went back to school. We lived in the Bay Area by that time. I went to San Francisco State, got a degree, graduated summa cum laude. I got a job in Silicon Valley, made a lot of money, was really on my way now. Didn't need Alcoholics Anonymous. He got his own business. So, you know, we're just rocking. We're in the throes now of what looks like power and what looks like success and what looks like we have legitimately graduated from Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea that you could be completely and totally enslaved by your alcoholism without a drop of alcohol in your body. But that is exactly what happened for me, is that all of my yets that never happened drunk began to show up sober. The hideous four horsemen, you know, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. It's interesting to me, I'll get to the big book later, but what happened for me was it just went to hell. I mean, I couldn't believe it. It was like, I'm 12 years sober in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sponsoring people. Of course, they're drinking. They're suicidal, you know, they're on medication. I'm going to, you know, a couple meetings a week with the other extra tortured people of, you know, Oakland Alcoholics Anonymous. And I can't believe that all this stuff is going to hell. You know, I'm in a death dance at work. I'm about to get fired again. I got into very serious legal trouble at 10 years sober. I had to hire a very expensive attorney to get me out of that trouble. My marriage was on the rocks. I was in horrible debt. We were trying to escape our reality every single weekend by racking up the credit card, escaping to Santa Barbara, because if we could just get back to Santa Barbara, that was the problem. If we could just leave this hideous, awful place, Oakland, and get back to Santa Barbara, well, you know, we were $25,000 in debt, just spending time, you know, getting away, and then driving back home, hating each other. Hating, you know, it didn't work this time. Once again, you know, it was like we were taking a drink, just there was no alcohol. So all of this came absolutely crashing down hard. My husband hit a horrible bottom at the same time, and he's suicidal, and I'm suicidal, and we are bewildered, absolutely bewildered as to what's going on. And I'm ready to drink. I remember the turning point for me, the jumping off place for me happened. I was 12 years sober. My life was in shambles. I was ready to drink. I knew that I was 3 hours away from a drink. Something said, like, if this something doesn't happen in 3 hours, you know what, I'm done with Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm done with you and your stupid God. I'm done with your haranguing about the four step. I'm done, and Alcoholics doesn't work. Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't work. They're lying. They've been lying all along. And of course, the reason it doesn't work is because I had never worked it. I had never worked your program. Clancy has this great thing that he says, that you're either walking toward your next drink or away from your last drink. And I don't know when I'm walking toward my next drink. That's how cunning, baffling, and powerful this thing is. But I was. So I was in my car in downtown Oakland one day. I just parked it and totally fell apart and sobbed. And it was like, you know what? I don't want to do this anymore. And I want to be drunk. I want to be drunk. And instead of taking a drink, here's what happened. I decided to not drink that day. There seemed like there was just this presence in my car, my simple little green Honda Civic, and parked in downtown Oakland, me falling apart. There was this big, strong presence in the car that just said, don't drink, go home. I didn't drink, I went home. My friend Eric called me that night, and he said, you know what, why don't you come to a meeting with me? Would you like to go to a meeting? I said, yes, I'd love to. And we ended up going to a meeting called the Wild Bunch in Berkeley. And at that meeting, my life completely changed. I saw a woman speak there who was my very first attraction in Alcoholics Anonymous. She talked from the Big Book, and she talked about the steps. And she was having fun. She was having a blast being sober. And she talked about surrender, and she talked about God, and she talked about, her experience, strength, and hope. And I'd never seen this animal in Alcoholics Anonymous ever before. I had never had that experience. And so as she talked, it was like, wow, I guess maybe there is something to this. And so I asked her to sponsor me that night. And she said, yes, I'm happy to do that. And here's what we're going to do. We're going to get together once a week. We're going to read this thing. It's been around the program a while. It's blue. It's called the Big Book. And what we're going to do is we're going to get together and we're going to read the first 164 pages. I'm going to read a page and you're going to read a page. And when there's instruction in that book of something you need to do, then you're going to take that direction and you're going to go do that. And I said, okay. So I sat down and I read, this is when I caught alcoholism, is when I read the Big Book. Up until that time, I was, too much of a deeply wounded, artistic white wine drinker. But when I read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was as if someone had taken the book, and between 1984 and 1996, when this incident happened, and, GSO New York got a new editor, and they rewrote the Big Book. Because I began to see myself in every page of that book. I couldn't believe it. It was like, one of the first things that struck me was, for us, there's no middle-of-the-road solution. That's all I'd ever done. I mean, that's all I'd ever done. I had never jumped in with both feet. My sponsor told me, she said, she heard my story, and I told her my sob story about my life. I'm 12 years sober, I can't stand Alcoholics Anonymous, I want a drink, I don't like it, it doesn't work, it works for them, it doesn't work for me, I'm too good for it, it's not good enough for me. All this insanity, she just listened to it. And she said one thing, it's 8 words, and I think that they're the most important 8 words that one alcoholic can say to another when an alcoholic is ready to drink. And it was read today, and it'll be read throughout the day, throughout your conference. It's 8 words. She said, Kelly, God could and would if he were sought. God could and would if he were sought. Not self could and would. Not your guru. Not your self-help book. God could and would if he were sought. She also told me about my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, you joined the club, you just never got the tattoo. And so, I set about getting the tattoo. And I did things that I'd never done before. I got on my knees and I did a third step prayer with her. Now, that's not in the Big Book. You don't have to do it on your knees. But it is probably the most important prayer that I can think of. I say it every day. I've said it every day on my knees for, 10 years now. I did a fearless and thorough moral inventory. Now, I had done inventories throughout those 10 years, and I had sponsors, but I always chose sponsors who were the easier, softer way, and you can find them. they're around in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never worked with a sponsor who had me go through the Big Book. I had never worked with a sponsor who asked me to take an inventory out of the Big Book. I always got to do my own inventories. My own inventories were basically, it's your fault and you screwed me over. I never had a sponsor who asked me to take responsibility for my resentments and everything that happened to me. It was always their fault. And so as a result of that, I got worse and worse and worse and more drunk and more undrunk rather than sober in the middle of AA. So I did this fearless and thorough moral inventory. I included for the first time in my life that very important fourth column on page 67 of the Big Book that asks, what was my part in it? You know, where was I resentful, fearful? You know, where was I dishonest? You know, what did I do? What was my responsibility in all of this venom and bile that was in this inventory? I did that. I went out and made direct amends for the first time in my life. Ask me how much I like that. You know, I had made amends in this time previous to getting the sponsor, but, you know, it was this form letter amends. You know, it was like, hi, I'm Kelly. You remember we worked together 5 years ago, and you probably remember that I did this thing. Basically, I probably wouldn't have done it if you hadn't started things. And so it kind of ended, it sort of like made half measures amends, and then the ending was this zinger of, you're the one who needs therapy. You're the one who needs help. You know, and I can help you. You know, if you do what I do, maybe you can be helped. And so it was always, you know, if where I really am is if I'm living down here, then I have to be up here. You know, I mean, that's how that period of dry drunk I think can be characterized. Is the less I worked this program, the more I really lived down here, and the less I worked for it, you know, the more I have to be up here because I feel so horrible about myself. And I don't have the drink anymore, you know, and so I've got to have, the broken sewer line is back, you know, so I got to take care of it in some way. So all this bluster and, you know, getting in trouble and I've got to be better than you. And I mean, this is just all the insanity. And, you know, when I read the Big Book with her, I always try to remember to say this. When you get to chapter 6, this is where Bill Wilson, in my judgment, really takes off the gloves and he takes out the 2x4 and he talks about, you know, the way that I really am as opposed to the way I think that I am. He talks in that chapter about I'm basically an actor and I want to, you know, I'm leading a double life and I want all the other actors to behave. I want the scenery and the ballet and the direction and the music and the lights to be just as they are, and then everything would be all right. And I remember when I first read that, it was like, you know, I noticed one thing about that description of my alcoholism in Chapter 6, that there's no statute of limitations on it. It doesn't say in Chapter 6 that when it describes that behavior, this ends when you meet him in AA. It ends when you have 25 years sober. It ends when you become a famous circuit speaker. It ends if you sponsor 10,000 people. You know, there are no qualifications to that behavior whatsoever. It doesn't even say in there that you have to be drinking when you're acting like that. And that's when I caught alcoholism, as I began to see me in that book. So I did this inventory and I made direct amends, and oh, God, I hated that. I mean, I won't dress it up. I mean, it was just hard. It's hard to go out and do this. It was for me. And, you know, I just did it. You know, I just did it because it was either, you know, just like it says in the Big Book, I was either going to live by spiritual principles or I was going to die a miserable death. And so I took this action and, you know, to tell you the truth, what I really wanted out of taking the steps out of the Big Book is I really wanted to be rewarded, because it was like I did this, you know, really humility, you know, trip, and I made the amends and all this stuff, and what I want now is the Beamer and a pile of cash. And when I got home from making all those direct amends, that is not what I got, but what I did get was the phone began to ring, and as the phone began to ring, it was Alcoholics Anonymous, and they would say things like, you know, we need a woman to share their experience, strength, and hope at a detox or a prison or a treatment center. Would you be available? And I was just taught at that point to not say no. At that point, I don't have a message at all because I've done it wrong, you know, all these 12 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I went anyway. And I began to do H&I. And I remember my first H&I commitment was Palm Avenue Detox in San Mateo, and I went there, and I just told this stupid story. I just told this idiot story. You know, I thought that I graduated from AA and, you know, did all this other stuff, and, you know, now it seems like I'm back on track. I'm in the big book. I'm taking the steps, blah, blah. And so I wrap that up, and I start to leave, and, this guy was, you know, all taped up and black and blue and missing teeth and really banged up, you know, comes over to me, and he says, thank you for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with me, because I related to everything you said. I, too, thought that I graduated from Alcoholics Anonymous, except I drank, and I've been trying to get back for 10 years. So if you're new, you know, it's not your business why you're asked to be of service. It may be that there's someone in that room the night that you're asked to be of service who needs to hear your story. If you are picking up cigarette butts or washing cups or whatever, you know, it's not your business what someone gets or what you think your value is when you're taking this very simple action. The point is that you need to take the action, because maybe that night when you're picking up cigarette butts, that's the one night that that person with 2 hours of sobriety needs to see you being of service. See, so it's not our business anymore. Clancy also says, you know, the action doesn't care why you take it, you just take it. And when you take the action, everything begins to change. It began to change for me. Everything got so different. The last thing that I ever expected to happen was that I would fall in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I said in the beginning that, you know, I don't like people. I don't like reality. Today I'm in the middle of reality and an awful lot of people. It's a different story today. Today I'm actively sponsored and I sponsor actively. If I sponsor people, I take them through the big book exactly as I was taken through the big book. I take them through the steps out of the big book. I don't put any spin on it. I have people make direct amends. The most important thing, I think, and I can't emphasize this enough, is that again, you know, the traditions really are probably the most important part of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life today, because they are the principles that I realize I came to this thing with absolutely nothing inside of me. There are no principles, no care for anyone else, no consideration, no, it was all about me. And I don't think that you can read those traditions, that you can practice them without profoundly changing, because basically they are 12 spiritual principles that I have to surrender to. And as I surrender to them, everything gets much, much better. And I found my appropriate place in the world. And it's a lot of fun to be there. And the smaller I get, the more I get. The smaller I get, you know, the bigger my world gets. But I am only made small through that humility of placing the traditions and the steps and the betterment of Alcoholics Anonymous above what I want to do, above what I want to say, above who I like or don't like in Alcoholics Anonymous. All that is now secondary to what these 12 principles, actually 36 tools, the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, and the 12 concepts of service. You know, those are the tools that I live by today. And it served me very, very well. And I'm very grateful to be an alcoholic today. I'm grateful mostly for the long-timers in Alcoholics Anonymous who kept this thing pure while I was out there screwing around, and who kept this thing intact and kept it, you know, as Dr. Bob said, one alcoholic talking to another. Let's not screw this thing up with Freudian complexes, he said. Let's keep it simple. Incredibly important, I think, to do, and I have a responsibility to that. Today, I just tell you the truth, I mean, my life is like a vacation. I mean, I love my life. I've had so much trouble in my work life that I decided about 8 months ago to stop working for people. I went out on my own and I became a freelance writer and doing corporate communications. Today, I work for myself. I still don't like the boss. But it's a magnificent life. I mean, it's a magnificent life sober, and I'm very, very grateful. Very grateful to you for Alcoholics Anonymous, and thanks for asking me to speak.
We hope you've enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12stepcapes.com.